you know, you get past the problems of location and inmate activities, these people, there's a heavy turnover in prison population. This system sees a whole lot more people than its total population every year. And no matter what a person's done, at some point, usually he gets out. And minimum security is important, if for no other reason, to provide a decompression stage for a felon who is about to go to the community. So within his last 6 months, year, 2 years, if he's been in prison a long time, we need to start getting him ready to live on his own. And an objective of minimum security is to get people involved either in work programs or education programs in the community so that that person can decompress. It's very traumatic to go from the controlled environment of a prison setting to the street. In many instances, or in many ways, it's a lot harder to live in the community than it is to live in prison when you're a person who has poor impulse control. So minimum security can provide that sort of a staged interface back to the community.
Well, you know, I had to make those comments. I know that we've got some problems, and I intend to help do most of them, although this does bother me, so I'll vote no on floor today. I would vote no again if I had the chance again, but then I didn't hear. Thank you, though.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Jones has highlighted a concern that was voiced by a number of members on the House floor today. And so probably one of the most controversial aspects of your job will be working with the siting task force around the minimum security facilities, defining those and gaining community acceptance for them. It sounds like it's going to be a real challenge.
Yes, sir, I would agree with that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, is there anybody else? Representative Jones.
When they get to a certain point, and I'm sure they'll be in that $12 million that's in the e-board, and if they site a facility and that part of it's taken care of, then can they start applying then or appealing to the emergency board for that, those funds?
They can start an application for release of the funds from minimum security facilities that are reserved to the emergency board when they have all of the applicable permits and when they have a plan that will show how the new facilities would reduce overcrowding and reduce the use of temporary leave. And there's a third thing.
Operating costs.
Operating, yes, and it has to show to the emergency board what the operating costs would be over the next biennium, so that the emergency board would have an idea of what the commitment it was making. All of those conditions would have to be met, and then the emergency board could vote to release the funds.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, though, with the time schedule that was put in the bill, and I don't remember just what it was, but they don't like the first part of it, whatever amount there was in there. That reverts, I believe, according to the language in the bill.
Yeah, all of the funds are available to them upon governor's signature, I think. No, and is it June 30th? Can't remember. Anyway, becomes available very early in the biennium. The total amount, all $12 million is available. Then comes July of 88, and $4 million goes away from the reservation and becomes available to the general emergency fund, and then the same thing occurs in September and in December.
Mr. Chairman, just to confirm for the record, even though the time frame is in place, and even though it would revert to the emergency fund, if there was some unforeseen delay, as Corey, I believe, wanted assurances, that we would not lock the money up permanently and disperse it for other purposes.
No.
I think the pledge was basically given that that the money, in fact, still would be there, even though it would be an emergency fund, if there was some unforeseen delay.
Then it would be competing with other uses of the emergency fund, and so the governor would have to make a decision.
Prioritize what he wanted the money.
Considering what problems were available at that time. As to what the governor would request.
I just want to reaffirm that.
But that certainly, yes, the money doesn't like vanish. It would still be available. The only thing is as you're getting that late in the biennium, the question arises, how much of it can you really spend in the months remaining?
So realistically, certainly by that September date, you're not looking at being able to construct much, you know, particularly in the fall and winter months. Okay. On Senator Wires.
Have you had testimony on the bill itself?
Yeah.
So have you heard why it's going to make the world better to have Corrections Division abolished and establish a new, it's going to be a new department?
Mr. Frank, would you like to tell Senator Wires how this will be, at least the state of Oregon, a better place? No, I thought not in quite those words.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, Governor Goldschmidt has, in my perspective, rather boldly and courageously adopted corrections as a principal part of his agenda for this term of office, and has indicated that he wants to resolve problems that exist in that area in terms of the use of temporary leave, the high number of probation clients compared to institutional population, the heavy loading in the institutions. And in doing that, he wants to be involved, and he wants to have the director of the corrections function reporting to him directly. The function of this bill is essentially to make that so on paper, so that the reality of their working relationship with the governor is reflected in the statutes. And I think that the governor has attempted to enlist the cooperation of the legislature in seeing that happens as we approach these corrections, or actually criminal justice system issues, more than just corrections issues.
Well, other than highlighting to the world that this is a high priority, which I join you in applauding, he could call the director of the corrections division in and talk with him on the current law. Do you see, I'm not trying to be critical, I'm just trying to pick up more ammunition here to support your position, but to be frank with you, but what structurally does it really do? There's certain things about when you make a department status instead of a division status and that kind of thing. Do you give me a little bit of the background on that?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, prior to Governor Goldschmidt's inauguration, the umbrella agency was exercising, the Human Resources Department was exercising review authority over the corrections division in terms of budgetary issues and other issues. I can suggest to you that it's my experience that there's very little operationally, very little overlap operationally between the functions performed essentially in a prison system and in a community supervision system and the operational functions that is performed by the umbrella agency and its other entities. Now, I cannot say the same thing in terms of fiscal or budget oversight. The fiscal and budget oversight is fiscal and budget oversight. But since the two things go hand in hand, and since the budget of the Corrections Division is more than large enough to justify standalone status, I think that it's appropriate to free the division both from operational and administrative oversight of the umbrella agency.
If I could add a comment, Mr. Chair, Senator Wires. We also saw a problem of basically human resources agencies and law enforcement agencies feeling that they were competing for resources. And one of the elements of Governor Goldschmidt's proposal is to remove that competition and to ensure the public perception that corrections is worthy of independent funding. It's not simply one of a competing group of agencies within human resources, and give it that independent status for that reason.
And one of the things that's happened already before the laws changed is that you're now in a different subcommittee of Ways and Means. One of the, just a philosophical observation, you mentioned it's difficult for people who've been living in an institution. You mentioned in a prison, but I think you'd agree that that's true of anybody who's been living in an institution, a total institution where they live there. They live by a schedule. It's hard for them to live on the outside. In a way, you do have, in that way, a similarity of the client population, human resources more generally, because people who are failing become dependent many times, and the state is taking care of them. That's one of the things that I think is sort of in direct conflict with, although both are true, that people are very dangerous on the one hand, and we want to confine them to protect ourselves from them. On the other hand, they're extremely dependent, and we're playing into their failing life plan when we take care of them the way we do.
Okay. Another argument in favor of the move is that many have argued, and I've been among them, who say the Department of Human Resources simply covers too wide a spectrum of issues and reaches a point of being very difficult to manage. In fact, as it's presently constituted, there's no state that has as many functions in one department as our Department of Human Resources. We're unique. But getting less so.
Mr. Frankie isn't on loan from anywhere, though, is he?
I don't know what kind of conditions there were, understandings.
There are no conditions. I can be, I did get a guarantee that I would get at least 1 second notice if I was going to get fired.
We got a guarantee that he'd fix it.
Yes. Okay, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Yes.
Chairman, I have a question.
Well, let's get to the work session, and then we'll have these amendments brought forward in work session. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2233 and simultaneously open the work session. Where do these amendments come from, Kate?
Mr. Chairman, these amendments were drafted at the request of the Department, the Division of Corrections, by counsel. I have reviewed them. They are essentially references that either correct mistakes that were made or else intended to harmonize anything that was overlooked. And I could go over those quickly if you'd like, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
On page 3, section 4 is the major expansion that the amendment creates. Is it really moves section 4 to section 4B and inserts two harmonizing sections. One that just says that whenever the division is referred to, it really now is the department, gives counsel the authority to make those changes. Section 4A does the same thing with assistant director and changes and allows counsel to go ahead and change director of corrections. On going down to the bottom, 4C is the section that was in originally. 4B just says that the division is abolished and terminates the tenure of office of the assistant director.
Or fires him.
The position.
Consequently, Mr. Chairman, it's hoped that both amendments will go through.
Yes, I see. It's tied together. Hey, you'll have a moment there, I guess. Maybe not that long.
An instant.
All right.
Page 44, there was a redundancy in the institutions that is deleted to take care of that. And on page 90, originally this bill created a community, It created a commission on corrections. It was intended that come out of this bill and leave in place the existing Community Corrections Advisory Board. So the amendment here makes that change. Mr. Chairman, there's one other place that requires that change, but I can bring that up after as amendments to these amendments.
Representative Jones.
Right, Keith, just what are we talking about in relationship to the council that was created last and the task force. We just introduced a bill to abolish the task force. Now, I don't want to be a part to reinstating that under some other title.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, this is the existing Community Corrections Advisory Board that has been inside of the Division of Corrections. Its job is to look over the community corrections plans and recommend.
It's been there before.
It's been there before. This is not the task force by another name.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
follow up on that. Do we need both the community corrections task force and this other task force for the siting of the facilities? Because a lot of their activities are certainly going to overlap to a degree.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, it's my understanding, and it won't take me too long to get out of my element here.
I'm being unfair to ask you the question, and I don't want to put
you
in a box.
I'll take a whack at it, okay. And Corey can kick me if I say something that's wrong. I'll try to stay within my limits of knowledge, but it's my understanding that the Community Corrections Advisory Board essentially performs a day-to-day function of administering the decision-making process for who and how much money goes into these field supervision programs that are handled by the counties as an ongoing operating matter, and it's been in existence for some 10 years.
Okay, so that's the one that the counties buy into the program,
yeah.
And all right.
Unrelated to...
Well, you're all right. Gets here one day and he's sharper than the guy. Jeez, I forgot all about that. No, I thought... sounds so much duplicative.
I was about one question away from my limit.
Okay. I am too, probably.
Well, the chair would move that House Bill 2333 be amended by the -3 amendments dated 4/24/87. Objection to that motion? Hearing none. So order. Now, okay.
On the bill.
We got more adjustments.
Oh, shoot.
We're going to fix it.
Mr. Chairman, I have three suggested amendments to the bill in addition to these. And I'll start at the back of the book. The first edition would be on page 91, and if you'll look across on line 22, this is just an oversight, and again, the same thing needs to be done that we just talked about. Commission on Corrections needs to be deleted in line 22, and the Community Corrections Advisory Board needs to be put back into the statute.
Okay. The chair moves that on line 22, page 91 of the printed bill, the bold material be deleted and the italicized language be restored. Objections to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Now we'll skip leaving the quote substantive issue to the last. Go to page 80, please. Line 39. If you try to read that, you run into some difficulty in interpretation, and I think I've agreed with the Corrections Division that we really should start deleting on line 39 the word after the. So it would delete, in addition to what's already recommended for deletion, superintendent of the penitentiary to the penitentiary, comma, by the. It will then read, and this is talking about inmates that have been housed in another jurisdiction and are being returned. It says, all inmates of this state confined in such other institution or jail shall be returned by the, and then you skip down to the Department of Corrections to Department Custody. This is taking out language when we were talking about the penitentiary, and it should apply division-wide or department-wide. So I think there's agreement that if we take out that language I just suggested, that this will be clearly.
Okay. The chair moves that on line 39 of page 80 of the printed and gross bill, the words superintendent of the penitentiary, and on the following line, to the penitentiary by the, be deleted. Objections? Hearing none. So ordered.
Now, Mr. Chairman, on page 87. I must chide the division just a small bit. This non-substantive bill has an increase in the division's revolving fund. This is on line 32. suggesting that it be increased from $10,000 to $25,000. We suggest splitting the difference and calling it 17.5. But in the process of looking into the issue, discovered that there are two reasons for which they use that revolving fund that are not covered in existing statute. And in order to prevent future audit problems, suggest that you add to the categories for which this fund may be used two additional purposes. One would be the emergency expenses of inmates released on temporary leave. And the reason for that, of course, is if someone were to go out on Friday and needed to pay the rent and it was an indigent inmate, it should be emergency expenses of indigent inmates released on temporary leave. So that would be one suggestion. And the other purpose for which this is used is for legal settlements where the Attorney General might stipulate a settlement which requires payment by a certain date or time, which doesn't permit the obtaining of a warrant from the Treasury. And that would be, I think we could refer to that as legal settlements for which immediate payment is required.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
Before we move on that motion, right. What is the the legal settlement? Is that like inmate brings a complaint against the state and it is settled in the form of a monetary settlement, and this is the type of issuance that would be given?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannah, I think that from what I understand, it's more nearly an employee with a grievance that is settled of some sort, and Mr. Colley can best answer what these kinds of situations are like.
Mr. Franke, would you like to respond, or would you like to defer to Mr. Colley?
Mr. Chairman, I've discussed it with Mr. Colley, and my understanding is it is litigation involving inmates rather than staff, and I'm prepared for amplification.
Both?
Both circumstances. Well, if I can answer that question, then is not the issuance of personnel-related issues dealt with by the personnel division? For this type of situation, as an example, a guard is working, say, overtime and brings a grievance or a complaint and is issued in his favor. You mean to tell me you're taking it out of this money to settle that up with employees?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, the emergency fund is, or revolving fund is not utilized for that purpose. Those kinds of payments are made through the regular payroll system as a supplement to the payroll. The circumstance that we're describing is where an employee has been dismissed or discharged, and through the involvement of their attorney and the Department of Justice, some settlement is reached as to the conditions under which they're going to be dismissed or discharged, and it may involve some type of a settlement as part of the process.
Isn't that usually conducted through the personnel division? It'd be no different than if you were a CSD employee and you've been terminated, and the person's personal representative in the AG's office worked out a settlement about where you'd be terminated at 5 o'clock on this coming Friday, and in return you'd receive a severance or whatever. That's what I understood your explanation just to indicate. Is not that handled through the personnel division?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, usually in these circumstances, the personnel division of the executive departments involve the Department of Justice. Labor section is involved, and it's usually not an issue of severance pay. It may be something analogous, a type of payment that would be analogous to a severance pay, but it's more legally, it is simply a settlement with that particular individual. And frequently there is a proviso that amount of money be paid
Forthwith.
Yeah, forthwith.
Mr. Chairman, if I could...
processing through the payroll.
I think the confusion here is that this is not the only... This is not a fund that you create and you pay those costs, and when it's exhausted, you don't pay anymore. This is a fund that's restored. So it could be restored by funds coming from the personnel
from
resources.
From personnel that pay back in.
Yes, sir. Or travel or the other areas that it's used for.
Is the 17.5 adequate?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have enough personal experience to say, but Mr. Cawley indicated to me that we've had occasions where we've come up dry because we've had to write a check, and then we've had some people go out that we needed to make arrangements for, and we've had a problem with that. And I think 25 was a number that we estimated would carry us, and I can't personally warrant that it will or will not. What do you think, 17.5? Should we
at
take
this,
it and run?
At this point in the process, 17.5
might be too much,
work.
Though. I was thinking it might be too big. Maybe 15. Could you live on 15?
Mr. Chairman, we could live with 15,000.
Did you get any advice from the state treasurer or the highway division? Say no.
Mr. Chairman, no.
Good.
Flowers are not included. Employee parties are not included.
You're working around to that $100 items that can be bought that are needed from time, which may be required from time to time. I guess the analyst's mention of audits makes me feel more comfortable about that. Otherwise, that sounds pretty loose.
This is apparently, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, boilerplate that's in most revolving fund accounts statutes.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add one piece of information. The Corrections Division revolving fund is managed centrally. There is no authorization for any branch office or field office to utilize the revolving fund.
Good.
So, for what it's worth.
Okay. The chair would move on line 32, page 87 of the printed bill, that $25,000 be deleted and $15,000 be inserted, and that on the same page, at the end of the sentence on line 34, that ends with expenses, are added the words, and emergency expenses of individual inmates on temporary leave. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant that should be a comma. Then another comma, and legal settlements for which immediate payment is required. Objections?
Well,
okay.
The alternative would be to put those under two as A, B, and C, and add a D and an E.
That's what I really meant to do.
Okay.
Quick recovery.
Thank you. No objections to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Well.
Move it out, Mr. Chairman, if we're ready.
One more question.
Oh.
I think it's section 2, subsection 2 of section 2. Somewhere in here I saw that the governor appoints the director with the Department of Corrections subject to confirmation by the Senate. And
section 2, subsection 2, page 2.
Then you're now the acting director subject to Senate confirmation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, no, I'm currently the administrator of the division, subject to being transformed into the director of the department, who would then be subject to confirmation.
We do. We need an emergency clause.
We don't have
one. How about an effect on passage?
Well, would it be effect or effect on July 1st?
Passage, I think. What would you like? Would you like it done right away quick? I think you would.
Mr. Chair, very speaking from the governor's point of view, we would, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chair moves that. The House Bill 2333 be further amended to include an emergency board, I mean, emergency clause, making the act effective upon passage.
Then the Senate could confirm.
You could move. You could.
Yes.
Section 247.
Right. Objections to that motion? Hearing none. Adopted. Senator Hannan moves House Bill 2333 as amended by the subcommittee to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask for one?
Sure.
Since this is a House bill and we don't like it over the Senate side, I would also move that prior to its arrival on the floor that it be printed engrossed as amended by our subcommittee. We don't like the versions that the House sends over to us as
we don't like it either.
So I'd like to, for that reason, I think that we should have it properly done.
Amended too. Senator Hannan's motion includes instructions that it be printed, be engrossed.
We send them over that way purposely.
Yeah.
Divide and conquer, I know.
And it's funny to get them to get up and argue about things that have been resolved in amendments that they haven't figured out.
Yeah.
Objections to Senator Hannan's motion? Hearing none. So ordered. There being no further business to come before the subcommittee, will adjourn until tomorrow.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ability to pay bills. So
you've been incurring bills without resources with which to pay them?
I've been paying them myself.
You've been personally?
Yes. So I'm tired of it.
I see.
My wife is too, she says. It has not been of great amounts, but it's kind of frustrating when you want to put out a $15 or $20 mailing to have to dig down. And it's not tax deductible. I haven't figured out how to take that off either.
Yeah. The purpose of the program is primarily historic.
Yes.
Educational.
Educational, essentially.
Some patriotism.
It's a happy blend of all of those.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you very much.
Coming. Mr. Regazzino. If I would have looked up, I would have known who you were.
See, your actor training has served you well.
Old drama instructor. Not old.
I mean, drama instructor.
Right.
Former. My name is Ed Regazzino. I'm the producing director and the vice president of the Eugene Festival of Musical Theater. We are a professional summer theater musical producing company operating in the Holt Center. Along with the Bach Festival, we occupy as resident companies most of the summer. This summer we're producing as our main offering 1776 the musical. I'd like to show you a short video, 9 minutes to be exact, that tells you something about the Eugene Festival of Musical Theater, and I'll tell you about this proposed tour. Hit the video.
We'd be delighted.
And all I can say is, Ed Regazzino's done it again.
I sat there asking myself a miracle never cease. Phil Armstrong, Peter Pan, and this. Guys and Dolls and Baby, and I'm sure that everybody in Eugene has to see it. It's a must. I've seen this is my third version of it. The sets, the characters, everything is absolutely professional.
A more professional show could not have been brought to Eugene, and I have seen lots of professional shows on Broadway. It was great. The music, the timing, the pacing, the talent that he manages to bring together is unbelievable.
The Eugene Festival of Musical Theater gives audiences what they want. great musical theater in a location that cannot be equaled in Oregon. Robert Lindstrom, the Oregonian, says, quote, Ed Ragazzino musicals have become a Eugene legend.
Do I hear it okay? Yeah.
The roots of the festival can be traced back to Ed's South Eugene High School days, when the general public of Eugene began showing up in large numbers for unusually high-quality high school musicals. The high school was used beginning in 1964 for an organization known as the Lane County Auditorium Association. It was a showcase for Ed's musicals, which had expanded to include talented adults from around the area in summer productions. But South Eugene High, the area's only real facility, was not air-conditioned, and the patrons hungered for a building that would house the summer musical treasures. Other arts organizations echoed the need. While the LCAA flourished for a while, and while several attempts were made, the auditorium bonds never got passed, and the building wasn't built. The LCAA summer musicals ceased in 1974. Ed Ragazzino had then moved to Lane Community College, where he helped design one of the most functional and beautiful theaters around. His reputation for excellent theater and outstanding musicals continued to grow. But the need and desire for the ultimate auditorium never left the City Fathers' minds. And through a rejuvenated effort in 1980, spearheaded by then-Mayor Gus Keller and former Mayor Les Anderson and community leaders like Maury Jacobs, the Holt Center for the Performing Arts was funded and built complete with an adjacent Hilton Hotel and Conference Center. The Holt Center was funded by Eugene residents voting for a property tax increase. The total complex cost in excess of $26 million. Eugene had made its commitment to the arts and opened its doors to a gala presentation broadcast live throughout the state on OEPBS.
We're honored to be with the governor of the state of Oregon, Governor Ventura. Governor Teal, what are your thoughts about your sports program?
It's really a lot of mixed and great emotions. I heard the word electric used before. I think it really fits here. That the people have to be proud of themselves, those that seen it and those that supported it. And of course, as a governor, I think it's great for Oregon. I mean, I know how great you feel about it. Let me give you a broader perspective. It's good for Oregon.
And this has got to be a terribly exciting evening for you.
It is. Absolutely tremendous. It's like being in labor for 18 years. It's here, and it's a magnificent baby boy girl. How is this going to help you as a theater director and theater in general, Eugene?
I think it'll help all of the local artists, because good theater and good music just fosters more good theater and good music. So, yes, the idea that there's an exciting center for international and local artists alike is just a great thing, and a long overdue thing, I think, for the community.
And you have been an awfully large part of that.
I think I represent a lot of people who have helped through the LCA summer shows. So in a sense, I represent those people, and there are literally thousands of people. So if anything, I'm their front man tonight.
This grand. We had to fight for places to play. We would use church basements and do readings for Kiwanis Club luncheons and practice and hone and take anything we could get. There was always talk about the complex, this beautiful, magnificent, generous in its size and its beauty. It was a dream. It was what I thought, truly thought, I might never see in Eugene. This is an incredible gift to generations, I hope, and it will be filled with music and a great deal of laughter, and finally, a great deal of love. It's always a pleasure to come back to Eugene, but I must say, this is a wonderful way to come home. Enjoy your evening.
The Oregonian's Bob Hicks was later tonight. Well, Eugene beat Portland to the punch with the Performing Arts Center. Last summer, the Oregonian wrote again, quote, a rich, warmly domed silver theater at the Hall, once again shows how much more amenable to musical theater it is than the cold and gaping Civic Auditorium or the cramped and technically inadequate Schnitzer Hall in Portland. Ed Ragazzino next entered the picture when John Cole, a Chicago ad executive, conceptualized a summer musical festival at the Hall Center, with Ed as the creative director, an idea from the past, still in the minds of many, but brought to life through John's initiative. The first season introduced Peter Pan. The Eugene Register Guard wrote, "Peter Pan not only flies, it soars," in a superb production. Peter Foy, the master technician who flew Mary Martin on Broadway, came to Eugene to engineer the flying sequences. The festival was off to a creative and financial success. In 1985, the festival produced Fiddler on the Roof. Critic Bob Hicks of the Oregonian wrote, "Fiddler on the Roof is simply the best musical theater production I have seen by an Oregon company for scope, nuance, sheer professionalism. Nothing I have seen in Portland can match it." Two in a row, financially and artistically. The newfound festival is doing what was called, quote, impossible by arts groups across the country. That is, to survive on box office receipts alone. Fresh from the first 2 years of success, the festival expanded in 1986 with two shows, the classical Guys and Dolls, and a recent Broadway show, Baby, which Ed had run successfully at LCC in the winter.
Guys and Dolls is a hit. Listen to what people are saying about this marvelous musical playing now at the Hall.
That was excellent.
It's a super show.
I'm really impressed.
Ed Ragazzino's done it again.
It's wonderful.
Worth the stop.
Oh, I'd recommend it for the entire community.
I'd forgotten how good Guys and Dolls was.
Everybody in the museum has to see.
Fantastic.
You know, it was great to be great. Listen to what people are saying about Baby, the other great musical playing at the Hall.
It's great. It's very touching.
It's hysterical. It's the funniest thing I've seen in years.
It's got the Ragazzino touches. It's beautifully choreographed. Worth the trip over.
It's definitely a real high quality performance.
It's exactly what happened in for you.
There's something in it for everybody.
Great.
It's never dull.
Don't miss it.
Eugene Register Guards, Paul Dennison says, simply fabulous. Eugene Festival Musical Theater is still on a high roll. The Oregonian said, crisply paced, visually dazzling. The company is firmly afloat artistically. Artistically, yes, but year three proved a financial loss and caused the festival board some anxious moments as each character had to pay their share of the loss. All commitments were made in full. Over 80,000 people attended in the first 3 years, contributed over $3 million to the local economy. Despite the financial disappointment of the 1986 productions, the festival board remains committed to the idea of a Broadway musical festival in Eugene. Encouraged by countless comparisons to the Ashland Shakespearean success, the board is confident and has organized to secure the festival's future, financially and artistically. 1987's production will be 1776, the stirring, rebel-rousing musical based on the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and inspired by a humorous celebration of freedom. With the nation celebrating the bicentennial of the signing of the Constitution, the promotional tie-ins will be plentiful. Eugene has the heritage, the facility, the organization, the personnel, and the support to create a special attraction that cannot be duplicated in the region. It's already a major tourist attraction for Oregon, a source of pride for the community, and now a financial and promotional opportunity for business and private citizens of the state. The Eugene Festival of Musical Theater, the emerging special Oregon attraction.
Follows is a brief opening statement from the musical 1776.
I have come to the conclusion that one useless man is called a disgrace, that a law firm and that three or more become a Congress. And by God, I have had this Congress. For 10 years, King George and his Parliament have gulled, cullied, and diddled these colonies with their illegal taxes, stamp acts, Townsend acts, sugar acts, tea acts. And when we dared stand up like men, they have stopped our trade, seized our ships, blockaded our ports, burned our towns, and spilled our blood. And still, this Congress refuses to grant any of my proposals on independence, even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God, what in hell are you waiting for?
Sit down, John, sit down, John.
Thank you for your attention on that. The governor's office found out that we're doing 1776 and felt that not a lot has been done by the state to commemorate the bicentennial of the signing of the Constitution. I was asked whether a tour could be organized, and I've done that for the governor's office in the document that you have before you, Mr. Chairman. Just a word or two about 1776. In no way is it to be regarded as some kind of stuffy, boring historical account of the founding fathers. It's powerfully entertaining, humorous, funny, and yes, even patriotic at times. It is the only musical ever to be performed in its entirety at the White House. The tour includes a four-city tour. In late August 18th, the first one at the Brit Festival, seating 2,000. The second one at Marshfield High School, seating capacity 1,100. A travel day to Pendleton at the Vert Theater, seating 805. Saturday night, a performance at the Civic Auditorium, and a Sunday matinee. The cost of the tour is $94,600. We have exciting and dedicated approval from the Benjamin Franklin Savings and Loan, and they have put in $20,000 toward this and are looking for more funding so that this project can become a reality.
I'm sorry, who?
Benjamin Franklin Savings and Loan. The Chief Executive Officer, Dale Waite, has personally assured $20,000 as one of the corporate sponsors. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
How much of this request has been discussed as being available for this tour, for your tour? There's a request for some $20,000.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Mr. McKay. How much of the
$25,000?
We're engaged, Mr. Chairman, in trying to raise additional private funds. And we would anticipate that of the $25,000, probably the bulk of it would go toward this particular production because of the cost of taking it statewide. Obviously, the more private funds we raise, the less public funds would be involved. There is an offsetting income from tickets, which will reduce the need to raise the full $94,000, but we'd have to raise enough funds to guarantee the payroll, so to speak. Right. And then as the ticket sales came in, there would be an offsetting revenue. So we're using this as seed money to get private money, but we would anticipate that a fair chunk of it would go into this project. It's the most ambitious one of those that are being contemplated by Judge Grickham's commission.
Okay. How certain is this as a go? By what time do you have to have so much money?
Our 15 performance run will happen despite action by the governor's office. So we will exist without the state's approval or participation. How certain is it? I have assurance that many of the business community, especially Dale, would really like to see the state participate in some major bicentennial commemoration because just not that much is being done.
I noticed you picked the Civic Auditorium in Portland to avoid the overcrowded and uncomfortable seats in the Arlington Concert Hall, but not so bad in the first five rows, though that is a little close to the stage, but there's a little room for your legs. I found that out. Okay, well, it's easy to lobby me on this. My Eugene roots, you know. David Oxton Cyrus, he never was a student of yours, was he?
No, when North Eugene High School. Northland.
It's amazing he ever got anywhere, isn't it?
Yes, without a lot of training.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Don, we'll need a budget and line item for this. Okay, next we're going to hear from our uniformed persons, I presume, the Civil Air Patrol. Thank you very much, Judge.
Are they going to...
I don't have any idea. Every day is a constant surprise.
They got to see the...
Mr. Chairman,
they've got handouts.
For your permission, I would like to hand out.
Hand out, sir. Okay.
Thank you.
You and the gentleman coming back.
Yes, I hope so. All right.
Thank you.
So, if you've got the money for these fancy handouts.
Sir, I want to mention that this was produced nationally, locally, and we cannot afford it.
To report to Congress. And to report to Congress. Nationally. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Earl Smith. I'm the commander of the Oregon Wing Civil Air Patrol. With me is Colonel Van Karas, who is the deputy commander. And we are here today in support of the request for the $20,000 funding for the 1987-1989 biennium under House Bill number 5049. The Civil Air Patrol is a national corporation with wings in each state. The Oregon wing is part of Pacific region, which is, includes Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, and Hawaii. We are requesting the money for Oregon in support of the maintenance program on the aircraft. This is the second time we've come in to request from the budget this amount of money. We've been under the e-board, we were given $5,550 in the past. This past 85-87, we were authorized $20,000. This isn't, this new request is a continuation of that request. You have in front of you material showing the fiscal year from 1982-83 through 1986. I will refer to that in just a moment, showing you where the money was spent for that appropriation. The Civil Air Patrol consists of over 600 senior members of volunteer in the organization in Oregon, and 400 cadets. The purpose of the organization is fourfold. We have search and rescue with emergency services, and this is in support of searches or emergency services for the Air Force, the Coast Guard, the Navy, the State Aeronautics Division, and the State Emergency Services Division, the county sheriffs and local authorities, and Red Cross. It also is in support of aerospace education, to try to keep the populace informed of the new developments and what is transpiring as far as the aerospace development is concerned. The next one is the cadet activities, which is to do with our teenagers, so that they can better help and better develop them and give them exposure to different types of activities to help them develop their minds and their bodies. We also have in that program an international cadet exchange, which is sponsored by the national organization, and Oregon is hosting this year some cadets from England. And Oregon has also sent some of their cadets, or sending some of their cadets in June into various parts of Europe as an exchange program. The one thing that has not been advertised to too widely, and we try to keep this in rather a hushed position, is the drug interdiction. We've been entering into this with the Customs Department, and have been quite active in the Florida area and California area, and are developing further as the need arises in the Washington area. They're talking of Oregon. At the moment, we have not been into that program, but there's been some requests from the sheriffs in the area to support this in the marijuana situation that we have presently. We've requested that we be officially requested to help, and this has to go to national for approval before we can get into this. Basically, I am told that the Customs Department feels that the marijuana program, or the problem, is basically a crop program rather than the hard drugs, and are not too interested in supporting this. So we feel that within the next few months we may have some progress in this area to assist in that area. The Civil Air Patrol maintains a 24-hour alert for emergency purposes throughout the state. The funding for the actual missions for fuel and some maintenance comes from the Air Force funding. This is directly from the Air Force, AFRCC, and Scott Air Force based in Illinois. Our request is not for this purpose. Our request is for the maintenance of our aircraft. And in support of this, I would refer you to my one exhibit that I had showing a number of figures on there showing the aircraft expense and recovery over the past several years. The total on this, we have down in the lower right-hand corner, shows the state funds, how it was applied, and then the maintenance, total maintenance, and the, if we had not had, in other words, if we had not had the state funding, we'd have been approximately $32,000 in the shortfall as far as our finances are concerned. We, as it is, we still have a deficit balance of $6,900, which has to come from other programs to support that.
But the state would have picked up the bulk of your maintenance costs, is that correct?
No.
No?
Not the bulk of it. It has supported it. It has picked up the shortfall, which our deficit.
And the total costs, or where do I find those? Are those, is that, when I add up the $54,550 from the preceding pages, say $389?
No, two separate documents.
So, of the total maintenance costs, how much do you attribute to the state?
The state is, be $25,550.
I see. Okay.
That's what the state has supported in the total. What we are receiving from the Air Force is the amount of gas and oil that is expended on each search, plus $1.77 at the present time per gallon of gasoline to go directly to maintenance. And this is the fund where we are in the shortfall in our total maintenance program. The Civil Air Patrol does not have pleasure flying. This is the pleasure to fly, I'll grant you. But we're not allowed under the program to use corporate airplanes, which are the Civil Air Patrol owned aircraft, to fly for pleasure. It has to be for emergency services or for proficiency. And this is to maintain proficiency within our organization of our pilots. And they are required to maintain that proficiency or they are not allowed to fly on missions. The safety is an important factor of mission flying, and Oregon is one of the toughest areas in the United States to fly missions because of the mountainous territory. the, of course, the all the mountain range areas are the difficult ones, and it requires a little better aircraft than in the plains area. Another thing is, if we do want to maintain our aircraft in a good mechanical condition for the protection of our pilots, and this we are able to do, we've been able to acquire new aircraft, not brand new ones, but newer aircraft to update our fleet from federal funding, but they do not support the program beyond the $1.77 per gallon of fuel.
I'll be right back. Of course. I'm curious about the answer to your question. Which is, what is the total cost of maintenance? And then it'd be nice to know how you derive what is the estate cost attributed to maintenance.
These figures are taken from invoices directly from the application of maintenance to the aircraft.
There must be a total figure somewhere.
The total figure is on the, just to the left of the state funding. Those are the totals per year.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Perry.
Without being able to answer the question that you've just directed, let me express the fact that the way that from the 1984, when the payment began, and it's $5,555, it has not been a ratio of state payment to a fixed maintenance cost, but rather a payment established in 1985 of $20,000 remaining unchanged this biennium, which admittedly is a proportion of some unknown maintenance cost, but rather reflects the contribution of the Civil Air Patrol to our state search and rescue missions, and what the value is to the state in that respect, rather than in a proportion of a maintenance cost.
So you kind of, you picked a number, 20,000 you figured is the amount that the Civil Air Patrol contributes to search and rescue through
the state,
to the state.
Of value to the state of Oregon.
So when they talk to me though about a deficit in what they call state funds, that's why I guess I got off on that other track. It was as though they had some accounting system.
Now, it's a very legitimate concern in the fact that they are running a deficit. However, in 1984, it was recognized that we could help with that deficit. But the reason for helping at all is because the state is deriving a signal value out of this organization in connection with its own search and rescue activities. But I don't want to mislead you into believing that we.